Fasten your seatbelts and turn up your radio. We're going on a road trip. In 1967, against a backdrop of civil unrest, Dr. Martin Luther King had a dream. But King's economic dream was perhaps the most direct: a guaranteed income for all Americans. Today, more than 50 years later, and against a similar backdrop of racial and economic unrest, a group of mayors, including one in Wausau, is bringing that dream to life. Proponents of guaranteed income programs, like the one launching soon in Wausau, say they lift people out of poverty and are effective tools to combat the economic devastation wrought by the pandemic, which has only deepened existing inequality nationwide. But others aren't so sure that direct cash payments are the way to tackle these issues, especially in a free economy. And they worry about accountability. Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shereen Seewert. The ongoing COVID-19 crisis has impacted just about everyone's life in one way or another, leading to an historic loss of jobs, while also exposing pre-existing cracks in the U.S. economic system. Last year, a Federal Reserve survey found that almost 40% of American adults wouldn't be able to cover a $400 emergency with cash, savings, or a credit card. Even bigger problems when more than 20 million Americans are now unemployed. Research has also shown a growing racial wealth gap, with a median white worker making 28% more on average than a black worker and 35% more than the median Latinx worker in the last quarter of 2019. Mayors in nearly a dozen cities, including Los Angeles, St. Paul, Atlanta, and now Wausau, are pledging to explore direct cash payments to help residents deal with economic insecurity. The mayors say it's time to move forward with the policy that Martin Luther King called for during the uprisings of the 1960s, fighting poverty with a guaranteed income to make sure that Americans can pay for their basic needs. Joining us today is Wausau Mayor Katie Rosenberg, who is about to launch a pilot program locally. It's the first in Wisconsin that will give a group of struggling families $500 each month with no limits on how the money can be spent. Mayor Rosenberg, thank you for being here today.
Hey, thanks for having me on your show. This is great.
Also with us today is Jason Davis. Dr. Jason Davis is an economics professor with the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. To tell us what the research says about guaranteed income programs and the potential impact on residents in the area. Dr. Davis, thank you so much for joining us.
Certainly. Thanks for having me.
We want to hear from you, too. You can email us at route51@wpr.org or join the conversation by calling 800-780-9742. When calling, please allow enough time for our producer to answer your call. So, Katie, let's start with you. How did you become aware of the Mayors for a Guaranteed Income program?
Sure. So I'm sure it's no surprise to you or anybody else that maybe follows me on social media, but I'm kind of an avid user. And I was reading some articles about this. Another mayor in Wisconsin had tweeted about this. And I looked at the article, looked amazing. And I just clicked like, and that was it. You know, I didn't think there was any opportunity here. But what happened was someone from that group reached out to me and said, "Hey, are you interested in this?" And of course, yes, the answer is yes. I'm always interested in things. So the rest is kind of history. We've had several conversations. And then you saw the policy action that went through city council. They're really excited about the idea of starting a pilot program right here in Wausau.
So Jason, people started really talking about the idea of income programs a long time ago, but it started to take center stage in 2020 when Democratic presidential candidate Andrew Yang made this universal basic income a major part of his campaign platform. But if I understand this correctly, a guaranteed income program is not exactly the same as a universal basic income. Can you explain the differences or similarities there?
Sure. So a guaranteed income program is usually targeted to specific populations, either based on income levels or family structure, you know, children in the household, things like that. Universal basic income would be distributed to everybody. And to some extent, that is kind of hidden by the fact that if we have universal basic income, you get this transfer payment from the government, and if you have no income, that's what you receive. As people earn more income, they're obviously going to pay more taxes. So that sort of program would have some sort of break-even point where you would net zero. And people earning incomes above that level have a net tax payment. People earning incomes below that income have a net tax benefit. One of the, you know, the main disadvantage of that is that it's obviously much more costly if we're going to send these payments to everybody. One of the benefits of that is when we use targeted programs, there's usually both inclusion and exclusion errors. So we end up including people that are essentially working the system, not people we're intending to help. And then we're also excluding some of the people that probably would really benefit from these programs.
Sure. So, Katie, let's get down to the nuts and bolts of, about what's going to happen in WASA. How will families be chosen? And is it $500? Is that how much they'll receive?
Yeah. So we're still in the planning stages of this. We just got council authorization last month. And, you know, we can decide the criteria on what kinds of people are chosen. It can be based on what you're making now, what your barriers are. What you intend, you know, how this will help you, how this will lift you up. But it will definitely be related to where you're at as far as poverty. We're likely looking at ALICE families. So these are people that are working and still can't make ends meet. And that was one of the big selling points, I think, to the council was that, you know, there's kind of a stigma of just giving people money. You know, we're in America, we all work for this. So really want to make sure that we're giving people an opportunity to help themselves and lift up, as opposed to just, you know, giving away money for free and not having any idea of what's going to happen here. So again, we're working on those criteria. We're going to pull in lots of community organizations who work with these populations to make sure that we're being as inclusive as possible while also making sure it's the most helpful.
How did you come up with the $500? Was that just the way the program dictated it or?
Yeah, it's not, that's pretty much the standard across the board. I think that's what it's enough to help people who don't have it, but it's not really enough to, you know, like quit your job and just stay home and lounge all day. So it's a helpful thing. You know, when you were talking earlier about people who can't afford a surprise payment of $400, this will actually help you. You won't have to go to the title loan company, and that's really damaging.
Okay. So no strings attached. The money can be spent on whatever they want. Jason, what do you think about that? When money is given to families with no strings attached, they don't have to spend it on a car payment. They don't have to spend it on food. Is that a good idea? From an economic standpoint, what do you think?
Sure. So, I mean, if we're talking about $500, that's not going to cover most people's like rent, utilities, groceries, things like that. And this has been a big debate, say, with food stamps and people want to make sure it's spent on food and not other things. But I think to some extent, if it's not so much that it's, you know, if it's an amount that's going to be needed for basic necessities, that's probably what it's going to be spent on. And we have a fair amount of paternalism when we look at how people receiving assistance spend that money. You know, I took some students to Chicago once and we talked beforehand that, you know, people would come up and ask them for money because I had some students that had never been to a large city before. And the first time it happened, one of my students gave the guy a $20 bill. And when we got away from that guy, you know, his friend hit him in the arm and said, he's just going to spend that on booze. And the kid that gave him the money said, well, good for him. That's what I was going to spend it on. So, you know, we expect people receiving assistance to perhaps have better behavior than we have ourselves sometimes.
Sure, sure. And Katie, did you ever question that? You know, the whole no strings attached part of this? Is that something that ever gave you pause?
You know, it's something that you always want to think about, right? You know, when we're working we want to do the most good, I think. But, you know, the research is already showing that 75% of these funds is actually going to food and clothing. So if that's where 75% of it is going, I think that's the right step. And if 25% is going to something that maybe I don't think is appropriate or the best use of it, you know, the other metric I think that we need to measure is human dignity and how people are able to survive and thrive in this world.
So how is the project being funded? This is not a taxpayer-funded program.
I'm glad you brought that up. That was a big question. People don't want to just throw out their tax dollars to this. So right now the pilot program is funded actually through Jack Dorsey of Twitter. He gave a big grant to this program. And, you know, I would say around where this started in Stockton, California, they're kind of in the shadow of Silicon Valley. So those tech folks are looking for ways to do good things. So this was one of those projects that many of those folks are interested in funding. So we will definitely do the research and take advantage of this if we can.
Jason, I know this is a really complicated subject, but what, in your opinion, are some of the most effective strategies that people could be using to lift people out of poverty? And does this type of program address the underlying issues of poverty in our communities?
Sure. So, you know, traditionally we've focused on targeted cash payments to specific groups like low-income single mothers. That's how the former AFDC program started. And there were some serious problems with that approach because AFDC participation was also linked to being eligible to have Medicaid, being eligible for food stamps, a lot of other things. And it created this welfare trap where returning to work, you not only lost your cash benefits, but you also lost your health care, you lost your food stamps, you lost a lot of things. And so, you know, we created a program where the economic rational response was to remain on welfare. And then we were angry that that was how people responded. You know, it wasn't that these are bad people. It's that we created a program with horrible incentives. If we look at the economic literature, if our goal is to provide assistance and promote work, the best policies would be wage subsidies. Wage subsidies are rather complicated to put into practice. And so the closest thing we have in practice is the earned income tax credit, which is a subsidy on earnings rather than hourly wages. And that's really proved to be one of our most effective tools for lifting people out of poverty. And we don't have the stigma effects that are associated with a lot of welfare programs. And, you know, because it's reporting to the IRS, we don't really care what the IRS thinks of us. you know, that's been one of the better benefits. The only disadvantage is that at some point we have to phase that out. And so as we phase out those benefits, that's kind of like your earnings are being taxed at a higher rate. And that can create some disincentives for working.
So, Katie, when we look at the Mayors for a Guaranteed Income website, the message of Dr. Martin Luther King is a prominent one.
Yep.
And he had a vision for payments for all, not in the short term, but for the long haul. WASA's program has 1 year, yes?
Yeah, likely so, a year, maybe a year and a half.
Okay. Do you see an opportunity for this program to perhaps be extended?
I mean, you know, anything is possible depending on the results we get. I think that's the really important thing about this concept is that, you know, we want to form good policy, good economic policy based on the research. So what you have to do is have these pilot programs to kind of prove that out. So you need the data. If it's proving out to be amazing, I would want to hope that there would be opportunities for funding, maybe not from taxpayers, but maybe through other sources. You know, the Stockton, California program was slated to end right when the pandemic was starting, and they decided that that was not a good time to end this for these folks, so they extended it. And they did use taxpayer dollars. And, you know, there are political repercussions for doing that, right? And so this for me is about the research adding to the broader body of science and making sure we're making the right policy decisions in the future.
You're listening to Katie Rosenberg and Jason Davis. They're here today on Route 51 as we continue our discussion on guaranteed income programs and their potential impact on poverty and inequality. When we return, a more specific look at how WASA's program will work and what other communities in North Central Wisconsin might learn from their experience. Your questions and thoughts are welcome. Join us by calling 800-780-9742. You can also email questions to Route51@WPR.org. When calling, please allow enough time for our producer to answer your call. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Jason Davis from the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point is here, along with WASA Mayor Katie Rosenberg, for a discussion on the pros and cons of guaranteed income programs like the one WASA is implementing as a first-in-the-state pilot project. We'd like to hear from you, too. Email us at route51@wpr.org or join us by phone. The number to call is 800-780-9742. So, Katie, what's the timeline looking like? Where do things stand right now?
Right. So in the next month or two, we want to develop the criteria and we want to develop the plan for how we will implement this. You know, there are a lot of complicating factors in this that the doctor alluded to, you know, as far as like, what does this do to taxable income? What does this do to the other benefits you might be getting? We want to make sure that we're supporting people who are in this program and not just kind of overly complicating their lives with more paperwork. So that's going to be part of this. So I would expect to have a plan in the next few months that we'll be publicly facing. I really want the council to buy into that plan too. There was some good discussion about it. So make sure that the community feels good about what we're doing, even though it's not their dollars. You know, it's their community.
What kind of feedback are you getting from other city leaders and people in the community about this program?
You know, I'm mostly positive. People are excited about the idea. You know, presidential candidate, now mayoral candidate in New York City, Andrew Yang, kind of popularized the UBI concept. So people are interested in how can WASA be a part of this bigger experiment that they're excited about it. But the other, you know, there's a philosophical challenge to some folks. They don't like it. Somebody, you know, commented recently, well, I wouldn't work either if I was getting free money. And, you know, I mean, if $500 is going to have you quit your job, I think that says more about them than the program. But, you know, there are some real philosophical challenges if you don't think this is the right way to enact policy.
Well, that brings up a good question. I mean, Jason, what do you think? Do these programs actually keep people dependent on the government?
I don't think this sort of program does. Is, you know, it as you increase the payment amount, then it's going to create greater and greater disincentives to work, and that's going to be sort of at an exponential rate. So, you know, we don't want to make it enough to live easily on, because then of course nobody's going to want to work. But if it's an amount that's just helping you pay basic needs, I think that incentive is probably small.
And I understand the Madison mayor is considering this in Madison as well. Katie, have you had conversations with her?
You know, we've had some kind of brief conversations. We're kind of missing each other sometimes. But yeah, she's really interested in doing this, and especially how it can affect affordable housing options. You know, and that's a discussion we've had here in WASA too at quite a few council meetings. So, you know, that's really the thing about this program that's kind of neat, is that it's a catalyst to how do we support people all around. I mean, when you see these things as successful, it's because you have these other community programs that are stepping in to help support and flank these families, so like the most support possible.
And obviously before the pandemic, many people were already struggling with poverty. Mm-hmm. How much more need is there now, nationwide, really, Jason? How much more need is there for this kind of program now compared to pre-pandemic?
Yeah, so, you know, looking at this within the pandemic, it's really difficult to say, because so many households have been hit in very different ways. You know, when we had the stimulus checks go out, which are kind of like a guaranteed income type of thing, but they're more sporadic. The first round of stimulus checks made a lot of sense to me, that they went to everybody, just because we wanted to do something that we could enact quickly and make a fast action. The second round, I kind of questioned that it should be more targeted. You know, I qualified for it, but I've suffered a very minor furlough at work. My income is very steady. I'm able to do my job remotely when I need to. And I have other friends that run small businesses that didn't qualify, but were devastated. And so, you know, I think the pandemic has hit households across the income spectrum in very different ways. And the people that typically we think of needing aid aren't always the ones that actually need aid today. I mean, we have a lot of new households that wouldn't have needed aid under normal circumstances.
That's interesting. And Katie, I find it very interesting, in fact, that this program is being championed by mayors. Why do you think mayors are the right people to spearhead these efforts?
Oh, man, I would invite you someday maybe to come to my office and listen to what people are saying to me when they call me on the phone or read my emails about what they're asking about. You know, I think that because I'm out there in the community, people see my face, and if they have a question about how to get support or where to go, they call me. And, you know, even last year, I had somebody who is experiencing homelessness, and they called me up because they saw me on the news and they said, where do I go? How do I get these services? And luckily I knew the answer because I'm involved. So I think it probably is a natural place to find the support for programs like this, because people are already asking us because they have needs that aren't met. And, you know, I think in general, not always, but in general, people trust local government a little bit more. And so there's that natural relationship. You know, they can come up to my office and see me. So it's not like making an appointment with Congress.
Sure. And Jason, you talked about your strong feeling that payments should be targeted. Does it make sense then to you that a mayor is one that can kind of decide how these payments are targeted? Is that one way to solve that issue?
Yeah, well, I think it makes sense. You know, as Katie said, people feel more connected with their local government. And, you know, currently our national politics clearly are horribly polarized. And when we look at things at a more local level, we tend to see less of that polarization and people being able to be a little more like-minded. But I would say if we were looking at implementing a permanent program, it would be more effective to be at a larger level than just the community, because, you know, if we say that you get a guaranteed income if you meet these criteria and you live in Wausau, that's going to bring more low-income people wanting to live in Wausau rather than neighboring areas, and it might make the people that are paying the taxes to support it want to live elsewhere. And if it's a broader regional scope, then we don't see that same you know, movement of people taking place.
And welfare stigma is something that we hear a lot about when it comes to programs like this. Jason, can you explain what welfare stigma is in general?
I will attempt to, and I will start by admitting that I'm a white privileged male, and I've never had to experience this myself. But, you know, I have friends that talk about, you know, being traumatized at lunch in school every day, giving their ticket to the lunch lady that showed they were getting free lunches. And I actually didn't notice that happening, but for the students that was happening, they were very aware of it. And even if people weren't judging them, they felt that they were being judged. And so, you know, we definitely have this stigma attached to receiving welfare payments of any sort, you know, and we've got comedians like Eddie Murphy making fun of it. And I think that's very prevalent.
It's interesting you brought up the school thing. I remember growing up here in Wausau and going to the elementary school, and the kids that got free or reduced lunch had a different color ticket to get their hot lunch. Everybody knew that their family was struggling, and I can see what you're saying. Katie, how much of a problem is welfare stigma in Wausau?
You know, there's some of that. I would say that maybe even though since the pandemic hit, so many more people have realized how close to the edge a lot of our neighbors are. You know, I've been volunteering at the food pantry, and, you know, a lot of times it's just you're handing out boxes of food. You don't know anybody, but there are a lot of people I know, and a lot of people, you know, they're people who work in the service industry. They're people who work at restaurants. They're people who maybe are cutting hair and they had to close down. You know, these are people that just without an option to be open are struggling. So I'm hoping that what this pandemic has done is shown everybody how close we all are to this. And I think the other thing that's interesting about this MGI program is that, you know, one of the outcomes could be that maybe a guaranteed income is a better option than welfare or food stamps or whatever that is. That's one of the hypotheses that they're talking about is, you know, maybe we don't need to be so ministerial about this. Maybe we just give them the money and let them go. So I think overall, if there is a stigma, we can work to end that.
And your program includes money for a researcher who's going to take this data and put that into kind of a bank of data, right?
Yeah.
So that's part of it, taking a look at how this works.
Right. Yeah. So we'll be hiring a research fellow that will work very closely, both with the recipients to kind of, you know, ask them questions. What are you spending it on? How are you feeling? What are these metrics that we're measuring? And then they'll also be working with the researchers from the University of Pennsylvania to make sure that we're collecting the right stuff, getting everything answered that we need to be, you know, really adding to the science of this and not just kind of flailing around on our own.
Sure. So, Jason, health economics and poverty are two of your primary areas of study. What can you tell me about that? What is the relationship between health economics and poverty?
Sure. So, I mean, when we look at health outcomes, there's definitely a socioeconomic link that we see worse health outcomes with lower income populations, partly because of a lack of access to health insurance. Part of it's due to environmental factors. You know, things like lead paint poisoning are almost exclusive to low income households today. And access to care, you know, especially in urban areas where it's very hard to find providers. There's very much a strong link between the two.
In researching this program, I've stumbled on at least one economic study of guaranteed income experiments that found that they can increase educational achievements and improve health outcomes without affecting the labor market. So, Katie, is that what you expect to happen?
I want it. That's what I want. I want to lift people up. I want people to be healthier. I want them to feel better about themselves. I want them to learn and be ready for school. That's what I want. Yes. And also I want them to express themselves through work, right? You know, I like expressing myself through work. And I think that you can find meaningful, meaning in that way, when you're not just worried about survival.
And Jason, what are your thoughts about that? Do you think that guaranteed income really does increase educational achievements, improve health outcomes without affecting the labor market? Is that a reasonable hypothesis?
So if we look at the research that's already been done, there were a handful of studies done in the 70s in Seattle, Denver, Gary, Indiana, Philadelphia, I believe, that looked at a guaranteed income type program. And those studies found that having the guaranteed income was linked to a 7% reduction in hours worked for men and a 17% reduction in hours worked for women. So those studies did find some reduction in work effort, but they also didn't really do the detailed research that Katie was describing and how did that impact their families. You know, somebody who quits a second job and goes from 60 hours a week to 40 hours a week so they have time with their family, that's probably valuable.
Valuable.
Right. A two-income family where one of the spouses, most often the wife, but not always the case, decides to stay home and be a caregiver at home. You know, that's one of those ironic things that we don't place any economic value on that. But if we pay someone else to do it, we do place an economic value on it.
Sure. Sure. What about minority groups? Are minority groups overrepresented in poverty, Jason? What do the statistics say there? I can't say statistics today for some reason.
Sure. They're definitely overrepresented. You know, if we look at the percent of minorities in poverty, it's definitely higher than we look at for whites. But if we look at the percent of people in poverty, you know, I believe over half are white just because we're a larger demographic group. So it's not a uniquely minority problem, but it is overly represented in minorities.
So I could think, a program like, oh, go ahead, Katie.
No, I was just thinking, you know, I think this is why you're seeing in some cities that are implementing this program that they are specifically targeting groups. In Pittsburgh, they're specifically targeting Black women because they're seeing that the outcomes that they're seeing because they're in poverty are so much worse, that they can lift people up even more. Just to get people better. So I think there is a really important relationship here. And, you know, Dr. King did point to that. And I think the research is showing that too.
Is that something that you think Wausau will do?
You know, I think we do need to look at the data and find out like where are those outcomes the worst? How can we make the most impact? So it could be, again, I want to make sure that we're making the right decisions, working with that researcher to have the best impact. It's also scary to talk about that as a policy, right? Because it feels like you are you're excluding people because of their skin color, and that's not something we want to do. But it's hard to talk about a program like this without recognizing that there have been inequities for centuries.
What are your thoughts on that, Jason? I mean, could a program like this, if it was implemented on a larger scale, promote economic equality among minority groups? Could that be a success?
I think it would definitely improve that. I think there's a lot of other issues that we would need to tackle as well, you know, such as education, you know. There's a lot of school districts that are heavily minority that aren't being funded properly, and that creates barriers for opportunities.
Absolutely. Thank you. Katie Rosenberg and Jason Davis are here today on Route 51 as we continue our discussion on guaranteed income programs and their potential impact on poverty and inequality. When we return, a look at the data from other communities with similar programs in place and what the future looks like for Wausau and the rest of North Central Wisconsin if these types of programs succeed. Your questions and thoughts are welcome. Join us by calling 800-780-9742. You can also email questions to route51@wpr.org. When calling, please allow enough time for our producer to answer your call. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Jason Davis from the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point is here, along with Wausau Mayor Katie Rosenberg, for a discussion on the pros and cons of guaranteed income programs, like the one Wausau is implementing as a first-in-the-state pilot project. We'd like to hear from you, too. Email us at route51@wpr.org, or you can join us by phone. The number to call is 800-780-9742. Looking at the data, the city of Stockton under Mayor Michael Tubbs was one of the first to try a universal basic income. So the study on that initiative found that people who were given an extra $500 a month, like what's going to happen in Wausau, spent the money on basic needs. They spent it on food and clothing largely. Jason, does that surprise you? Or is that what you as an economist would have expected?
Yeah, that's what I would have expected. I mean, It clearly is supplementing their income, so it's helping make those basic needs affordable. Some of that probably also leads to things that are less basic, but nice things to have. You know, I mentioned the studies earlier that showed the reduction in work hours, and that's, you know, definitely one of the negative aspects of a program like this. But at the same time, the reductions were much less than the cynics would have thought. They were also more than the advocates were hoping for. And I'm really interested to see the results of this study, because the studies I looked at were done in the 70s. You had a fairly large impact on women's work hours. But I think the presence of dual income households were much less present in that era. And there was also a lot less access to childcare. And so that would partially explain why we saw that larger response. I'm not sure the same would be true today.
So, Katie, how will you know that the program is or is not a success? What data will you rely on?
Well, I would rely on, understanding how it has improved human health, well-being. Are folks able to, I love the educational outcomes. I mean, just being home to do homework with your kid is a big deal. If you're not doing it, or if you're relying on your older kids to take care of your younger kids while you're at work. So I'm very interested in how people are viewing their own lives. If they're feeling healthy, if they're feeling those metrics, that's what I'm interested in the most. But obviously, you know, I want to know what people are spending it on. That's a curiosity. I think that's a data point. And part of me, while I'm glad it's going towards those basic needs, right? The majority of it, part of me is also a little sad that that's where we are, that that's what it has to do. You know, like when you think about economic stimulus, you don't necessarily think of the basic needs, right? So, but I'm glad to be a part of it. I think it's important right now.
To be fair, there is some significant criticism of these kinds of programs. Some people say it's a handout, it's not a hand up, and that doesn't fit with America's economic model. Some even consider this a form of socialism. So, Jason, what do you think about that? What do you think about that criticism? Is it valid?
Yeah, there's some validity to that. I mean, it's natural that we all treat money differently when it's found rather than being earned. You know, if I work a bunch of overtime and my take-home pay goes up by $100, I'm going to be very careful about how I spend that $100. If I find a $100 bill on the sidewalk, I'm going to go buy something stupid. And I think that's just kind of a natural response that, you know, when we earn things, we do tend to be more focused on how we spend it. But if we're targeting this toward families that are already struggling to meet basic needs, I think that's probably less of an issue.
Katie, how do you respond when somebody says, hey, this sounds like a socialism idea. This is a socialist program. What do you say to that?
I mean, it wouldn't be the first time somebody called me a socialist, and at least this program kind of has, you know, that vibe. But, you know, for me, this is about the research. It's about getting better economic policy. It's about just being better leaders. So I, you know, if that's how people want to approach it, that's fine. I will say that across the spectrum of political beliefs, I've heard from folks who are interested in supporting this kind or being involved in it even. So it's not just a lopsided political view.
One of the chief criticisms of programs like this is that it could be better to spend money like this on short-term assistance that helps people achieve financial independence. So I guess, Katie, how do you justify spending money on a program that some say would create dependency?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the easy answer for this is that there's a limited time for this pilot program, right? You get a year and a half and we're done. So that's the easy answer. Whatever comes next is probably the tougher philosophical thing, right? And hopefully any policy is decided based on that data. Now, I don't know. We have all kinds of programming that's available to folks that need it, housing assistance, food, things like that. And sometimes we make it so tough to get that, you know, that housing assistance is one of those programs where you really got to make sure you're filling out the paperwork correctly and all of that. So I don't know why we wouldn't want to try both, to get people lifted up in both ways. So it feels like this one way isn't working solely on its own. So let's try some other things.
Jason, what are your thoughts? Should public money be used to foster independence and autonomy instead of the way this program will work?
Yeah, well, I mean, if we had a guaranteed income program that doesn't go away under, you know, a normal set of changes in incomes and things like that, that actually doesn't create as much dependency. You know, there was a study in France that looked at guaranteed income in place of unemployment insurance payments. And they found that with guaranteed income, people got reemployed. Some people got reemployed faster because the benefits didn't go away when they got a new job. And they found that some people were unemployed longer, but were finding jobs that were a better fit for them and for the employer. And so, you know, by not removing those benefits, I think it actually creates perhaps less dependency in some cases.
So does a handout create an incentive not to work, or does it have to be a handout at a certain level before it creates an incentive not to work then?
It depends how it's phased out. You know, the original AFDC program, if you had a dollar of earnings, your benefit was reduced by a dollar. So that's like having 100% tax on any earnings you have until you get beyond that benefit level. So if it's phased out more slowly, there's going to be certainly less of an impact on that.
You know, Katie, you were talking about the way that you interact with residents, that they're calling you, that you're hearing their concerns, that you're hearing their voices. What relationship does the municipal government have with the overall economy? I know that's a broad question, but what relationship should it have?
Wow. You know, obviously it feels different at a local level. You know, we don't print money and things like that, but we can do things that help drive people to programming that helps them better understand their own finances, right? We can support that. We can help drive people to those, you know, Department of Workforce Development. You know, I've had enough meetings with folks about how do we help people who are getting laid off right now. So I would say it feels like we're more part of that nurturing element, but you know, we also had the opportunity with CARES funds when those came through to dole out grants to local businesses. And that was really impactful. I thought we were able to help those people stay either if they needed to stay closed and pay their employees maybe, or if they wanted to do renovations, if they needed access to low income or low interest loans. We were able to help direct people there through our relationship with McDevco and also getting those funds from the state and federal government. So it's kind of a mixed bag. You know, again, we don't print money, unfortunately or fortunately, depending on how you view this. It's probably better to have that done nationally.
Jason, what are your thoughts on the relationship between the government and the economy?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
I mean, what do you think that the relationship that between municipal governments and the residents, how does that trickle down to the overall economy? I mean, does it really start at the municipal level?
Yeah, I think it does. And I think, you know, we see that people are much more engaged in local issues than they are in national issues. And so that's where we really see that public engagement in the political process more prominently. The overall economic financial issues are best done at the federal level, but I think a lot of the important work is really done at the local level.
We have a caller. It is Orlando from Wausau. Thank you for calling. What is your question, Orlando?
Hi, my question is this. The program does appear, I'm a conservative. The program does admittedly sounds socialistic, and it begs the question, is there a better way of doing it? Your other commentator, not the mayor, mentioned something about a wage augmentation. I've heard of a program that makes sense. I heard it years ago. For example, let's say someone is entitled to $10,000 worth of social service money over the course of the year, state, federal, municipal level, doesn't matter. Why not augment him $5 an hour relative to the 2,000 hours someone works in a full-time job, and that would be $10,000. So if he's at McDonald's and he's making $12 an hour and he's entitled to $10,000 of social services, make his wage $17 an hour. That way he has the same reinforcements of being privately employed with his boss, with his coworkers and stuff like that. It seems like if we're going to concede that the government is going to pay for people's well-being, that this seems like a much more conservative approach to do so. I'd like your comments.
Sure. So, you know, as I said earlier, if our goal is to provide income support and promote work effort, the economic literature says that we should have wage subsidies, which is what you're describing. The difficulty with wage subsidies is that they're very costly to administer. There's a lot of paperwork to keep track of how many hours worked and how much the subsidy should be, et cetera, et cetera. There's also potential issues where if some jobs qualify and others don't, that people apply for jobs that have subsidies are going to be.
Can I interrupt there just one second?
Sure.
I understand an employer already has all the records of hours worked, all of them. There would be nothing to turn those over. And the programs that we're describing, and every time we create a new program, it requires people being employed to administer it. You know, I would beg to argue that a wage augmentation is actually much simpler and much more cost effective than another new program.
Yes. The point I was trying to make is that I think expanding the earned income tax credit, which is an earnings augmentation, would be an easier, simpler method than augmenting wages in terms of administration. Your point about socialism.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Regarding your comment on socialism, any type of transfer of income to low-income families could be interpreted as socialist. And that's a term that I think gets overused. I don't think any country is completely capitalist or any country is completely socialist. There's this continuum between the two.
I was just going to say the earned income tax credit, if you correct me if I'm wrong, that's given no matter what. I mean, all you have to do is be employed, and at a certain dollar amount, you just get money returned to you. The wage augmentation directly goes to how you perform at work. In other words, there's a need to want to keep your job, to still be good to an employee to your employer. In other words, this money comes if you stay working and you stay a good employee. Whereas the earned income tax credit, if you just cut your own hours, you get more money.
All right, thank you, Orlando. Thank you for making that point. That is interesting. Katie, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, so Orlando, if you want to go to Congress and advocate for this, I will be right next to you advocating for our working class. I think you're probably going to hear from some folks that, you know, augmenting a McDonald's worker or whatever is definitely subsidizing corporations. But you know what? I think we need to focus on the goal of helping people, helping lift people out of poverty. And so what that looks like, I am open for that experiment. So if that's something that the government wants to help fund, I will be there advocating right next to you.
So Jason, what more does need to be done to address poverty right now? Orlando had a good point there. What's it going to take to get people out of the situations they're in right now?
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't have all the answers. It's a very complicated subject. And if I did have the answers, I should be in Washington and not in central Wisconsin.
I'm glad you're here.
I mean, I think income is a part of it, but I also think we need to address disparities in educational quality and things like that to create better opportunities.
Interesting. You know, Katie, do you think that it's possible to make this program sustainable for the long haul? I mean, is that something that's down the road?
You know, I wish I had a crystal ball. I think that what we need to do is look at the data. And I keep saying that, it's annoying. But if the data is showing us that this is successful and it's helping people, I think that we'll find the community rallying around it. I think that that's something that they want to see, though. Right now, it's kind of an unknown, and people just want to see how it works. So if it works, if the metrics meet the needs of our community, then, you know, be out knocking on doors of the foundations, talking to people about how to make this happen on a wider scale.
We only have about a minute left, but we have Paul on the phone from Merrill. Welcome, Paul. What's your question?
Well, it's not a question. I tuned in late, so pardon me. I've just read a book by an economist named Stephanie Kelton. It's called The Deficit Myth, and it deals largely with the mystery of what money is. So to all of your listeners and to your guests there, I would recommend Ms. Kelton's book, The Deficit Myth, as being very pertinent to this discussion.
Thank you, Paul. Much appreciated. I want to thank everyone for calling and both of our guests today for this program. That is all we have time for today on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Once again, thanks to our guests, Jason Davis from the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point and Wausau Mayor Katie Rosenberg. Our producer is Joy Ratch-Kramer. Our executive producer is Rick Ryer. Rick is also our on-air producer today. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. You can hear the archive of today's program at WPR.org/Route 51. Next week, we'll hear from state representatives on their reaction to the governor's budget address and what kinds of legislation they expect to move forward in the coming weeks and months. Until then, we're heading out of town.